Good morning, everyone. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our May 3rd Santa Ana Water Board meeting. We are meeting in person and via Zoom, and this meeting is being webcast and recorded. For those who have completed a virtual speaker card for the Zoom meeting, you will be on mute and your camera turned off until it is your turn to speak. The host will then unmute you and ask you to turn on your camera if you have one. When you are done speaking, you will be placed on mute and your camera turned off. You can remain in the Zoom meeting or exit the meeting at that time. For people who only want to listen or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is available. At this time, I'd like to ask our board members to please introduce themselves, and I'll start with board member Al Lopez at the end. If you push the little gray button.
Morning. My name is Al Lopez. I'm the former mayor of Corona and former water board member for Western Mitchell Water District.
Welcome. Board member Alvarado.
Good morning, everyone. Gloria Alvarado, resident of the city of Santa Ana, and very glad to be here. Thank you.
Board member Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Letitia Clark, I'm a resident of Tustin and also serve on the Tustin City Council. Happy Friday.
Good morning, and I'm John Scandura, and I'm from Huntington Beach. This past week, Huntington Beach lost a major leader in Shirley Detlaw. She was 88 years old. She was active right up until the end. In fact, she died suddenly in her home. She was actually preparing for some meetings that day. Shirley was on the city council from 1994 to 2002. She actually was mayor in 1997. And then midway through her time on city council, Governor Gray Davis appointed her to the California Coastal Commission. She's had many accomplishments throughout the years in the city. Among them included being a founding member of the Amigos de Bolsa Chica, which ultimately negotiated saving most of the Bolsa Chica wetlands. She was also known for developing a policy on human dignity in the city. This is in the 1990s when there was a rash of hate crimes. She was very active in homeless issues. She was also a housing advocate and, of course, an environmentalist. For me, she was a personal friend for about 25 years. She was a mentor for me in all my activities in the city. And then, interestingly enough, a few years ago, she called me one morning and said, John, there's going to be some openings on the Santa Ana Regional Water Quality Control Board. Why don't you apply for them? And so the rest is history. So I'd like to dedicate this meeting to Shirley.
Thank you, Vice Chair. I knew her in a more formal capacity and thought the world of her and the work over the many decades of her public service. So in her memory, let's please close our meeting to honor her service to our region. So thank you for bringing that up. My name is Chris Murray. I am chair, and it's my honor to lead our meeting today. We'll move on to item two, which is our public forum, and we welcome hearing from the public at this meeting. Any person wishing to speak should have submitted a speaker request. For those items listed on today's agenda, you will make your comments at the time the item is being considered. If you wish to speak on an item that is not on the agenda, you may speak now during the public forum. Comments will be limited to 3 minutes. Jessica, do we have any speaker cards?
Yes, we have three speakers. The first will be Chris Bland.
Good morning, Chair Murray, good morning, Vice Chair Scandura, and board members and staff. My name is Christopher Bland. I'm with the San Bernardino County Flood Control District. I serve as the Stormwater Program Manager for San Bernardino County Stormwater Program, and I represent the 18 permittees listed in the MS4 permit. I'm in front of you today regarding a topic from March 15th board meeting. At that meeting, my manager, Arlene Chun, requested additional workshops and an extension for written comments on behalf of the Tri-County Group, all 60 permittees listed in the new regional MS4 tentative order. We greatly appreciate the regional board for granting the extension for written comments. There was also a discussion of future workshops to review the tentative order section by section with regional board members. Shortly after the March 15th board meeting, the permittees learned of these board workshops would possibly be held during future board meetings. Unfortunately, the latest information received was these regional board workshops will no longer take place as a public workshop during board meetings and will be done without public involvement. The public will be given a single four-hour workshop to discuss the tentative order with board staff only during the comment period. On behalf of San Bernardino County Stormwater Program's permittees and our respective executive managements, I urge board members to be present during these possible workshops and hopefully during comment period to kind of understand our perspective and every perspective of the public during this time. We believe it would be beneficial to all parties involved to understand the permit provisions and receive feedback from the public pertaining to the tentative order as well as board staff. Thank you for this opportunity to provide feedback from the San Bernardino County permittees, and I wish you guys the great rest of your day. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments. Jessica, do we have any further speakers?
Our next speaker is Richard Boone.
Good morning, Board Chair, members of the board. I'm Richard Boone. I'm Chief of the Watershed Protection Division for Riverside County Flood Control. And I'm here really to talk to you on the same issue that Chris and one of my former Orange County colleagues is going to come up here to talk to you about. And that is the process that you have for engaging on regulatory matters of that I would characterize as high consequence. And one of those is going to be coming before you towards the end of this year or early next year. I may be here on a misunderstanding. We very much value the relationship that we have with Jane and your staff and the access that we have with them. And my experience is I can pick up the phone or send an email and I hear from Jane and have the opportunity to talk to her and her staff when I make that request. We very much value that access. But in matters of high consequence, we are very keen, both the district and the permittees that we represent, keen to have the opportunity to talk to the board members and have the board members engaged in some of these very key deliberations. So I would just leave it at that, recognize Jane's accessibility and willingness to engage, look forward to hosting your staff at a workshop at the district in the not too distant future, and again underscore the ask from Chris that we have the opportunity before this next regulatory action that is of concern to us to have you engaged with us in the discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our final speaker is Ananda Carr.
Good morning. My name is Amanda Carr. I'm Deputy Director for OC Environmental Resources. Pleasure to have you again back in Orange County. It's wonderful to have your meetings so close by. I will support the comments made by Chris and Richard, but then I'm going to veer off and just let you know what we are doing as what we refer to as the Tri-County Group. So San Bernardino, Riverside, Orange, and all of our permittees. We are meeting on a biweekly basis. We are coordinating and drafting a single comment letter that's going to encompass all of our comments together. Where we are now is we're calling today pencils down, and our consultant team is going to be consolidating. We've been all working off of a common document. Our consultant team is going to consolidate those comments. We will then distribute it to our 60 permittees for their review to make sure that we have all of the city and municipal comments combined into one comment letter. Not barring anybody submitting additional comment letters, but we want to have one consolidated comment letter that really encompasses as much of our thoughts as possible as a tri-county group. So we are engaging a significant amount of time and effort to make sure that we're as streamlined and as coherent as possible to bring this information to you. And we would really appreciate the opportunity to have that discussion once you have all of our comments. So we are chugging away towards that July 3rd deadline. But just know that you'll be getting a very comprehensive packet of comments that have been hashed out significantly between the Tri-County group before it gets to you. So we really appreciate the opportunity to engage in the future. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for all the work that's happening behind the scenes as well. Yeah, please.
I just want to state, I talked to Richard, Amanda, and Arlene, and Chris beforehand, and James. I think there was a little bit misunderstanding on the process of what we're going to do with the MS4. You know, this initial meetings are just to be able to talk frankly amongst the staff on what the comments are, get ready for the July 3rd comments that are coming to us. I'm going to take time to educate our board on the permit and the nuts and bolts of it, which is what we do with the permits that come before them to vote on. But I can promise you that there will be for sure one full-blown workshop before we go to a public hearing. It could be more than one. I think one is the absolute least. There could be two. It all depends on where that conversation goes and where we get and where and are we ready to make a decision on that permit. So I just want to clarify that and apologize if you were misunderstood where we were headed. But we will take the time that we need so that we can make a good decision on this permit, understanding that there are areas that are going to need discussions with the board and with the permittees and with the NGOs and other interested parties. So if I can just hopefully say that publicly and make that promise.
Thank you. Thank you, except from our executive director for clarifying that. And then our vice chair has a question as well.
Yeah, yes, I had a question. So I think the comments from the three previous commenters were about the workshops. I think the four workshops they talked about, those are strictly internal workshops, right, for the staff and the board members?
Yes.
Yeah, and that's just initially getting the board members to know what the acronym means, the nuts and bolts of the permit, and then we'll all get together and talk about the permit. So, and it's not uncommon. This is how I educate the board on what comes before them, in all the situations we do briefings. This one's a little bit. We'll do a little bit more time just because of the size of the permit.
Right, and these are normal internal agency deliberations. One of the key things is we ensure that when board members are present, there isn't enough to constitute a quorum. And I think another concern came up that the board members may not be able to come to the public meetings, and I think that was something that I think raised their concern. They just at least want us to be there and observe the comments and that are made there. I mean, granted, we're not going to be able to participate in the meeting or make statements or comments or anything like that. But I think that's something we should look into, is whether board members can just be physically present to observe.
Yeah, I think we need to hear from council on that. If you could speak up.
We could set up the workshops that way. I don't know if the notice has gone out yet. I did review a draft notice. It's not noticed as a board level workshop. We can change it to a board level workshop, but there will be additional procedural requirements that would apply. And attending to observe is the same as attending to participate. We can't distinguish between the two. So if we do change the format so that board members are participating, feel free to participate fully, but we'll just have to decide which format to use and provide notice accordingly.
Any other questions from the board members? Okay. All right. We'll move forward then. Thank you very much for the comment. I'm sure we'll have some more deliberations with our own staff on this one, but we hear you and we appreciate your time here today. Okay, moving on to item three, I'd like to introduce our State Water Resources Control Board member and liaison to our regional board, Didi Diamo, who will provide an update from the State Water Resources Control Board. Didi, the floor is yours.
Good morning, Chair Murray, Vice Chair Scandura, and members of the board. Good to see you all. I'm going to start off with some updates on drinking water So on April 10th, the Biden administration issued the first ever national legally enforceable drinking water standard to protect communities from exposure to harmful PFAS, which I know is one of the top priorities for your region. This final rule represents the most significant step to protect public health under EPA's PFAS strategic roadmap. On April 17th, our board adopted a maximum contaminant level of 10 parts per billion for hexavalent chromium, a cancer-causing contaminant. And this new MCL will reduce affected Californians' potential exposure to what's also referred to as Chrome 6 to one-fifth the current regulatory level. And then on May 2nd, our safe and affordable funding for equity and resilience for drinking water. We have an advisory group and they held their second meeting just this week on May 2nd. Okay, switching gears here to an update on sustainable groundwater management. We've been quite active this year. On April 5th. Our staff held a virtual workshop regarding the proposed designation for the Tule Subbasin, which is in the southern part of the San Joaquin Valley, and as a probationary basin under SGMA. And then on April 8th, staff held an in-person workshop in Porterville. Our board will be taking up this matter in September, on September 17th. And there's a public comment period that ends on May 7th. And then on April 16th, our board actually held a hearing on a basin just further south, the Tulare Lake subbasin. And we did designate that basin. This is the first time we undertook action for probationary designation. And we did place the basin on probation pursuant to the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. The basin now will be responsible for submitting reports on their extractions. They'll be subject to our fees. And then we would be able to, not sooner than 1 year, develop an interim plan to manage the basin. But the basin does have that at least 1 year to respond to the issues that were called out in the staff report that led to the basin being placed on probation. And then on April 17th, our board adopted a resolution to revise the interim mitigation payment calculation for the water quality control policy on the use of coastal and estuarine waters for power plant cooling and proposed a final staff report. And at the end of April, for 3 days, we held a multi-day public workshop to learn more about a proposal that's before us for the Bay Delta Water Quality Control Plan update. We hope to be able to take action on the Bay Delta plan within the next year and a half. And we have received a package from a number of public water supply agencies suggesting that we consider an alternative to the unimpaired flow approach. And their package has been referred to as voluntary agreements, but they have a title for the package now, and that's the Healthy Rivers and Landscape Program. So this would be a combination of flow and non-flow measures that these parties are proposing to undertake. It was a very productive 3-day workshop, and I expect that the next time this will come before us in a public setting would be sometime later this summer, where we would receive some information from our staff regarding how they would propose a program of implementation for the water quality control plan, including for these voluntary agreements. On May 22nd, later this month, our board will be holding a public workshop, which is something we do annually to receive information and solicit public input regarding the status of the phase one program for the Salton Sea Management Program. This workshop is for informational purposes, and our board will not be undertaking any formal action at the workshop, but these are always really good opportunities to hear from the resource agencies and the local entities that are and stakeholders. They're very active in management of the Salton Sea. And then lastly, I wanted to let you know that briefings have begun regarding the water use efficiency staff proposal for outdoor water use efficiency. And we did hold a workshop in March, collected additional comments. And so looking at any further revisions that we would have to make, stay tuned for that. I'm hoping that something would be released, later this spring regarding that, possibly by the end of the month. And I believe that we're slated to consider this for adoption in the summer, I believe in July. So I look forward to providing additional updates for you all on that. I know that's water use efficiency has been an issue that you all closely follow. And that's all I have. I'm happy to answer any questions. Oh, I forgot one thing. I understand that some of your members are interested in receiving a budget update. I'm sorry, but I'm not able to provide much information. I know in particular, there's a lot of concern that the regions have regarding implementation of the 401 certification for dredge and fill as a result of the Sackett decision. And that is still in play, but we still don't have any information that's publicly available regarding the May revise. And so the next time we meet, I hope to be able to provide that information to you.
Thank you very much. With that, I'd like to open it up to my colleagues. Does anyone have any questions for Dee Dee? Vice Chair Skandura?
Good morning, Dee Dee, and thank you very much for the report. Early in your report, you mentioned about probationary hearings that are going on with some of the sub-basins, particularly Tulare and then Tulare Lake. I understand from the press that there's still some more basins that are going to be coming up. So I just wanted to ask about that. And then secondly, are there any sub-basins in Southern California that are either up for probation or being considered for probation?
Okay, a good question. So yes, we've received in the first tranche, and these the SGMA deadlines. There are two important deadlines for submittal of plans, and the initial plans get submitted to the Department of Water Resources for their review. This is very much a partnership. We're sort of the backstop, but we've been working very closely with our sister agency at the Department of Water Resources. So they undertake the initial review, and the first tranche was for basins that are in critical overdraft. And so these are the areas where, we've all been reading about in the press about land subsidence affecting critical infrastructure like the California Aqueduct that we all rely on throughout the state, or two thirds of Californians rely on. And so that was the first round, and we received most of them had the green light from the Department of Water Resources, maybe some issues for corrections, but not significant enough to warrant any further review over at the State Water Board. But we did receive six basins in that first tranche. They're all in the San Joaquin Valley. So there's the Kern sub-basin, Tulare Lake sub-basin, Tule sub-basin, Cahuilla, Chowchilla, and the Delta Mendota sub-basin. And with those six, we prioritized and felt that it was most important for us to go first over at Tulare Lake because of the significant subsidence issues. And then another important consideration for us was the potential for drinking water wells to go dry because of overdraft. Another important consideration is impact of water quality, potential for plumes, contaminants to move around in basins because of overpumping. So that was kind of our criteria in figuring out, the level of priority. The Tulare Lake, as I said, they went first. Tule would be, I think, in September. And then I expect that we'll have a draft staff report coming out soon for the Cahuilla sub-basin. That's over in in Tulare County. These go overlap multiple counties, oftentimes, I think, part of Fresno. And we do expect, though, for the Cahuilla sub-basin, that we will be receiving an updated plan for us to review. And so there is that ability for these basins, even if they've been sent to us, as the staff is preparing a staff report and as we prepare to go to hearing, you know, we're really encouraging these basins. Take a look at what's been called out by DWR, take a look at our staff report, and make the necessary adjustments and update your plan. You know, the whole idea here is we want to see success, and success is best management is local management. So that's really what we are encouraging. And thankfully, so far, I don't believe anything from Southern California, but there is that second round, which is basins that are not in critical overdraft. And so I know that some of the basins are under review for that over at DWR. I will take a look and get back to you if there's any areas in particular in Southern California for me to call out.
Thank you, Dee Dee.
Thank you so much. Your reports are always incredibly informative, and we appreciate it, as do those in our region who listen in. So thank you for incredible service and support of our region, I should say. With that, we'll move on and wish you a very happy and safe weekend. And
thank
look
you.
Forward to talking with you soon.
Have a good board meeting. Thank you.
Thank you. So next is item 4, and this is a new item that will be a standing item on every agenda. So I'd like to, I'm going to you, Jane, but I see you walking that way. I would like to introduce Jane Joy, who will provide an update on racial equity activities in our region.
Well, good morning, Chair Murray and board members. Again, Jane Joy, Executive Officer for the Santa Ana Regional Board. I'll be providing the update on the racial equity activities. And as Chair Murray just stated, this will be a standing item on our board agenda so that we can let you know what our new practices will be, how things were going to change, and also we can seek input from yourselves and the community. Next slide. I'll cover two areas today, basically strategic objectives and the Santa Ana Water Board activities. Next slide. In review, this is from the racial equity resolution. These are our strategic objectives. And basically what everything that we do needs to be geared towards one of these objectives, and they do overlap and build upon each other. So our focus will be to integrate racial equity and measure the impact, create and maintain spaces of inclusion and belonging, activate Black, Indigenous, Latinx, Asian, and people of color community wisdom, and share that power and knowledge within our communities. Next slide. So today I'm going to just go over these strategies. Maybe they're just in a little bit more simple terms, but I'll talk about each one first. But I did want to mention that we do have a dedicated racial equity team. It's comprised of 11 staff, and they have been helpful in shaping the regulatory program. They're compiling the action plan, and they're also a resource to all staff for questions on where we're headed and what we're doing. And that team will stay in place as we go forward. Next slide. So to improve coordination and alignment, initially but we'll continue to identify who to talk to in our region and what events can we connect, can we attend to connect with our communities. But specifically, we developed a list of interested parties, persons, advocacy groups, and tribes. Initially, this list came from the State Board when they started their activities. And then we've been adding to that as we have found people that we feel will be interested. There's still kind of potential, but there's 700 contacts on this list, so it's pretty extensive. But we'll refine it as we go. And several of these parties will receive our public notices, and they've also agreed that they will share our notices with their constituency. And a few of them I have talked to, they're very, very eager to help us, which is get the word out. And I think that will just create more connections. We've created what's called a public information group. It's called Gov Delivery or Government Delivery. It used to be called the LIRIS list. It's basically an automatic list of these 700 contacts. And we're able to take that list and send out all of our public notices and provide information, provide announcements, and it disseminates it to this entire group. We feel it's a good way to manage this large list of contacts. And so we're going to continue to use that. And people can sign up on it too. When people get familiar with those that we don't normally work with, about how to work with Gov Delivery, you can go into our website and sign up and get on our list to hear our announcements. It's just one way to communicate. For tribal interactions, though, we did not include them on the Gov Delivery list. We made the decision that because we're speaking government to government, we're going to approach the tribes with a little different fashion. We'll be emailing them directly. We also are providing a hard copy letter. We found that that is useful as well. The tribal lists we have, it came from several sources, but we also continue to look at what the State Historic Preservation Office has, or SHPO, you might have heard. They'll keep a current list of the tribes that are within our area. And as you know, we've received a few inquiries from our tribes on some of our projects. So I feel it's encouraging. It feels like we're maybe reaching some of those tribes. And then we've been able to either email with them or sit down with them and talk about these projects. So we're slowly building some connections with our tribes. And again, we're finding that it's best if we go to events that are already planned and become a part of that rather than try to create our own and request people to attend. Next slide. So building internal capacity is a key to success, a successful program for the workforce and program execution. The State Board developed a document. It's called Immediate Action Plan for Advancing Workforce Diversity. The principles in this document are designed to help us meet the goal of having a workforce that meets diversity in our community. And some of these actions include or actually require that hiring panels have expertise in implicit bias and racial equity. And the State Board offers training and coaching in these areas. And so we took advantage of that. It requires a diversity statement in our job advertisement. It also requires establishing a modal diversity interview questions during interviewing. And then we are to target recruitment efforts to improve our diversity. And we've taken action on all of these, and we will continue to do so as we go forward. For example, for recruitment efforts, Dr. Brian Covolo from our office had a career day at the University of California, Riverside. And it was with other staff from DTSC, or Department of Toxic Substance Control, and Department of Fish and Game, and our staff. And we met with them in a classroom over a full day. And the staff was able to come in and explain how they got their job at the water boards and what it does and what it entails. It was really a successful event. I was in attendance, and the classroom, it was like the students could come and go as their schedule allowed. And that classroom was full almost the whole time, nearly full. And then there was one-on-one conversation that we were able to have with the students. I really enjoyed that. And it was a very nice setup. So we're going to try to duplicate that at some of the other universities and colleges in our region. But we've also taken opportunities with some of our community groups that have been set up to talk about careers. Two in particular, one it was geared towards the Black communities, and another one was geared toward Hispanic communities. So our staff did attend that and helped assist with those questions. So that program is growing with all of the transition and staff. It's happening statewide. This is really an important aspect for us at this time, I think. We also take training and mentoring seriously in communicating. So because in my mind, this is our top priority, every opportunity we can to talk about racial equity and how we can improve our process, we take that advantage. We meet weekly with our senior staff. We meet monthly with all of our staff. And then even at the staff level, those who are more involved with the public outreach, they meet every 2 weeks to share what's working and what's not working. And I'm seeing a real shift in attention and engagement from staff to move this, move the ball forward. Next slide. So expanding engagement, as I mentioned in the beginning, we're changing our approach and we're looking for groups and tribes that are interested in water quality issues in the Santa Ana River, and looking particularly at what their interests are and what and where they're involved. I have met with a couple of key individuals. I will be following up with them in the next couple of months. Hopefully I can bring back some specific examples at future meetings. But it is happening, and we are moving forward. And I think it's always important to remind ourselves that we're public servants. It's our responsibility to implement new policies to improve the lives of all Californians. Next slide. This isn't really a strategy, but it's an important aspect of the work that we do. There are hard tools in place that really help us to do our work. And I'll just explain a few of them. There is an EJ screen. This was developed by US EPA. It displays a database that combines environmental and demographic indicators in the US. It has a linguistic isolation areas that are put on census tract, and then it's all placed on a map. So this is a useful tool. CalEnviroScreen 4.0, it was developed by the Office of Environmental Health, Hazard and Assessment. This is a mapping tool that highlights the relationship between pollution burdens and population characteristics in California. Again, it's a mapping tool that puts environmental health, socioeconomic, and linguistic information onto a map. And then lastly, I didn't cover them all, but the State Board has developed another linguistic tool. It's called Linguistic Isolation, and it's used to determine what languages are spoke within the affected areas. And what's meant by linguistic isolation is it refers to households where no one over the age of 14 speaks English very well. And so what we can do is, if we're working in a community, we can use this tool saying this project is at this location, what languages are spoken in that area. And then when we create information that goes out, it can be printed and translated into that specific language. And State Board is able to do quite a few languages, so we've got some good support there as well. And then my last slide, next. In advancing equitable outcomes in existing programs. You know, we're incorporating what we've learned, and we're putting it into an action plan. We're looking for opportunities to support regional environmental justice projects. And many of these opportunities are gonna need funding. So we will have a focus on the funding that's coming from the state grant funding and see where we can provide a support on that. And just yesterday, Chair Murray signed a letter to the Congressman Ken Calvert to support a $5 million grant for Quail Valley. So I really appreciate that. Thank you very much. That project's been in the works for a while, and it's definitely falls in line with a disadvantaged community. So I hope to report more specifics in the future. We will try to have that action plan done by summer. We're working, it's coming along. It's not ready for publication yet, but it's getting there. And I have any questions. Next slide.
Thank you so much. And we really appreciate the tools, the resources, and the dedicated staff to this program to really make sure that this is an effective effort in our region. With that, I'd like to open it up to our colleagues. Board Member Clark.
Yeah. Well, first, thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing this to be a standing item on the agenda, at least in the beginning, while we're getting this program and, you know, rolled out and the action items associated with the resolution so that we just, you know about the updates, which I just think is great. A couple questions about public outreach, which I think is a very effective tool and action item to for us to go to the communities rather than asking them to come to us, to our public meetings, et cetera. I guess my question is about budget, and I may have asked this at our last meeting. Do we have funding associated for us to go out? Because, well, one, for staff time, and two, just, you know, to have swag or things to give away or things to make a booth or table appealing is going to be better than a white tablecloth and, you know, two chairs. But we need probably funding associated with our outreach efforts so that they're effective and we are getting people to come to us if we're tabling at an event, et cetera. Or we may need to pay to participate in some of these events. And then my other question was just about our outreach to minority professional associations or organizations. I'm thinking about like the National Organization of Minority Architects or NSBE, National Society of Black Engineers. I know they have Orange County or Southern California chapters. So reaching out to them and letting them know about, you know, job opportunities, but also in their mentoring programs, letting the next generation know about what's possible and in the world of water. And then my last question would just be associated with social media presence. If we're talking about, you know, illuminating representation, even the members here on the board to the community, that's hard to do with just the website or internet presence, but a social media presence could really make a difference in us, you know, reaching out to these different communities. So I don't think we have a social media presence right now. So I wonder if that's something we want to work on. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for those questions. I'm interested in all the above as well.
So for budget, I do understand that we will be given some money to do just what you said, to help participate in events and probably pay and maybe even pay for some consulting services to help us. We are able to use some of our general funds to do a booth and some of those other things too, but I don't have the funds yet from the state board for specifically that action, but we are pursuing it. But we can do some, and currently the staff time we have is our program staff time. But, you know, we do need to do public outreach too, but I am seeking those fundings, and actually, you know, hopefully we'll get even more resources such as staff too in the future. As far as talking to the minority profit organizations, associations, definitely we have. I do believe that Keith Person has spoken to some of these associations for the Black engineers. He's an engineer himself, and he's been doing that himself. I'm a little reluctant for the Water Board to take credit for that because it was his own initiative, but we will pursue that. And I know there's other opportunities out there who we might be interested. You know, just at the UCR event, it was really engaging to watch our staff talk about what was the steps they took to come to the Water Board and why they came to the Water Board. And I think as a student, just trying to figure out, you know, you're in that age where you don't really know what you're going to do and what's before you. It's a little bit, there's a lot of unknowns. I think our staff can help to at least show a path that worked for them, and then they can decide whether or not that's appropriate for them. So, yeah, we will look for all those opportunities. I don't think that's a hard thing to do at all, and we'll probably really enjoy it. Social media, we do a couple of our team, racial equity team members are social media experts. I am not. I'm old. But we do have a couple of people that are very good at that. So we are looking into it. The state board does have a Instagram. I'm looking at Jessica. They have some accounts. There's Instagram, there's Facebook.
But we are looking into that, and we might be able to create our own too. But we'll look for opportunities to get the word out in that fashion. But I will let those that know how to do that really well do that. It wouldn't be up my alley, but we.
Thank you. So yeah, the social media does help, especially with the younger generation. And I even think Facebook is dating us older folks. So
I do.
They're far more.
I was, it came out of my mouth, and I thought, I think Facebook isn't
talking about MySpace these days. Okay. Director Scandura, did I see you? Vice Chair Scandura?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you, Jane, for the excellent report. It's interesting because when I was at DTSC, I was involved in a lot, because I was a hiring manager, I was involved in a lot of the training efforts as well as recruitment. In fact, I think in my last couple of years, we had a similar career day for UCI students. And I think it's good that this agency is also joining hands with other agencies like DTSC and Cal Fish and Wildlife, because they too need to meet these kinds of requirements. I had one question. As far as the tribes, do we now have a comprehensive list of the tribes in our region? And the reason I ask that is because from time to time, especially when we have meetings and workshops, it may fall on a day of significance to local Native American tribes. So we'd want to be able to acknowledge them.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And we're learning about even there's some other specific dates that are for other communities that are important too. We do have a list of tribes. And so it's about 22, 23 tribes. And we have the addresses for the lead or the chief, is the correct term for the organization. But we also, one of our staff, Rajan, is he's very familiar with working with the tribes, and he was able to locate within those tribes the person that actually does the environmental work. So when we send out the information, we send it to both, so that that we're just trying to make connection, and I think that's working. But yeah, it's about 22, 23. Today, that could change,
all right. Thank you.
Would anyone else like to ask any questions or speak at this time? Yep, Board Member Alvarado.
First of all, I just want to say thank you for the report. I think this is great that we are kept aware of what's going on and all the amazing work that your staff is doing. So thank you. I know you said that the team is 11, but I'm sure that it's everybody who is actually being, tapped into talking about racial equity. And one of the comments that I would like to make is that perhaps working with the counties as well, some of the regional centers have the opportunity to talk to other individuals who may be interested in pursuing a career. And so the one-stop centers in Orange County, just to mention a few, we have three work investment boards. So we have the county, Santa Ana, and Anaheim, and that's just one region. So perhaps if we work with the other counties, we'll be able to also include them and, have the opportunity to do a larger outreach. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you. We'll see that.
Thank you for that. All right. Seeing no further comments, we'll proceed. Thank you so much for this update. Yeah. One last question. Will the PowerPoint that you just presented, will that be on our website?
We can put that on the
website. I think that'd be good to have on our website. Yeah. Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
And with that, I will move on to item five, which is the approval of our meeting minutes for February 2nd board meeting. I'd like to request a motion and a second for that item.
So move.
Moved by Board Member Lopez.
I'll second.
And seconded by Board Member Clark. Jessica, would you please call the roll?
Thorntender Lopez.
Aye.
Thorntender Alvarado.
Yes.
Thorntender Clark.
Aye.
Vice Chair Scandura.
Aye.
Chair Nuri.
Aye.
That item is approved. We'll move on to item six. I'm sorry, seven. Are we going to seven now? The meeting minute. Oh, we have two sets of minutes. Forgive me. Item six is approval of meeting minutes for the meeting on March 15th. And I would like to request a motion and a second for that item.
Move to approve, Madam Chair.
Moved by Board Member Clark.
Second.
Seconded by Board Member Alvarado. And Jessica, please call the roll.
Board Member Lopez.
Aye.
Board Member Alvarado.
Yes.
Board Member Clark.
Aye.
Vice Chair Scandura.
Aye.
And Chair Murray.
Aye. And that item passes as well. We'll move to item 7, which is consideration of the consent calendar listed as items 8 and 9. And at this time, I'd like to ask if there are any interested persons or board member requests to remove any of the consent items. Jessica, do we have any speaker cards?
No, there are no speaker cards.
Okay. Any members of the board? I see none. I do want to just emphasize here that we have an errata sheet for to be considered as part of the motion to adopt for items 8 and 9. So we would need to move 8 and 9 with the errata. And do we have a motion to approve?
Motion to approve.
Moved by Board Member Clark.
Second.
And seconded by Board Member Alvarado. And Jessica, please call the roll.
Board Member Lopez.
Aye.
Board Member Alvarado.
Aye.
Board Member Clark. Vice Chair Scandura.
Aye.
Chair Nuri.
Aye. Thank you. That item passes as well with those two consent items. So we'll move to item 10, which is a presentation on land disposal program, a report and regional landfill regulatory program overview. And I would like to welcome Cindy Lee, our senior engineering geologist, who will provide an update on our land disposal program activities. And Cindy, the floor is yours.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the board. Yeah, my name is Cindy Lee. I'm the supervisor for the land disposal and DOD program in this region. Today, I'll present to you an overview of the land disposal program. And here are the topics I'm going to cover today. First, I'm going to talk about the introduction, talk about our staff, what we do, and then we're going to brief introduction on the regulations that govern our activities. Then I'll talk about the different kind of facilities we regulate, landfills, surface impoundment, composting facilities. At the end, I'll talk about the groundwater cleanup at a land disposal facility. At the end of each topic, I'll pause for questions. So here I'm going to introduce our staff. We have Joanne Lee, the Water Resources Control Engineer. Keith is also an engineer, but he got promoted lately in March. Bill Rice is engineering geologist. Patricia Hannon, she's also a geologist, but she does a DOD program. Two scientific aides, Fernanda and Victor, and myself. So we land support program is a core regulatory program that protect groundwater resources. We regulate discharge to land from these different kind of facilities, including landfills, composting facilities, and surface impoundment. And in terms of our day-to-day function, what we do permitting, we drafting WDR with discharge requirement, revisions, renewals, or expansion amendment. When the facility goes through the expansion or closure or post-closure, and we either do the individual WDR or general WDR. When that occurs, that will present to you for approval. And then we conduct inspections during the facility expansion or according to the permit compliance. And post-rain inspections, and also respond to the complaint. Then once necessary, we do the enforcement, the permit. If there's permit violation, there's illegal waste disposal, or there's a contamination of drinking water sources. And review reports, we read last reports on engineering designs, construction plans, and construction quality assurance reports, and joint technical documents, closure plans, monitoring reports, and financial assurance reports. And also we do the program management. These are manage the requests from state board or provide analysis to them and prepare the agenda item for board meetings, database management, and track our performance. Other activities include the groundwater cleanups at the land disposal facilities, such as the PFAS investigations. I'll talk about one case towards the end. And sometimes do clean closures, or sometimes do post-closure and land development. And I want to mention here is that we also work closely with our sister agency, Cal Recycle, a county local enforcement agency, to especially during the inspection or post-closure land development, and we work really close with their partners. I want to touch quickly on the regulations that govern our program, the Water Code, of course, the California Code Regulation Title 27, and State Board's Resolution 93-62, and the Federal Municipal Solid Waste Regulations, 40 CFR 258, whenever there is more stringent requirements there, especially on the report, the monitoring and reporting programs. I also want to touch on the history of the regulation. It's by no means the complete and thorough, but to give you a sense that regulation has changed over time. This board, or the predecessor of this board, regulates landfills in the 1950s, according to Dickey's Water Pollution Act. And then you'll see as the regulation evolved and a more requirement placed on the landfills, especially, I want to touch on the 1985 Solid Waste Assessment Test Program. That's when we start require operators to install groundwater monitoring wells. And lo and behold, we discovered release. So over time, we start require liners and leachate collection removal systems. The 1993, the State Board Resolution require the geocomposite, so that means it's the clay plus plastic. And the most recent regulation, the Title 27, as I mentioned before. Because of the evolution of the regulation of landfills, and you'll have all kinds of facility in our region, some are not lined, some are like old burn dump all the times, and then modern day landfill is equipped with a leachate collection removal system, gas monitoring, and even at one given facility, you will have one cell that's not lined, and then the later constructing cell at the modern environmental control measures. And the way we regulate or protect our environment, regulate the land disposal facilities by waste classification. It's a hazard waste. This DTSC is in charge of the hazard waste. I'm sure the vice chair is very familiar with that kind of work. And the designated waste, this is defined by Water Code as a type of waste, if not contained, will cause exceedance of water quality objectives. And then non-hazard solid waste. These are the wastes that probably pose least threat to environment, that include municipal solid waste and inert waste. Municipal solid wastes are some of the wastes you kind of blow out to your curb every week. And even that, you would usually require some kind of sorting so we can recycle the recycled material and the green waste. And then I think the brown bin goes to the landfill. And I also include the picture of this inert waste. Looks like, you know, construction debris, concrete, dirt. So these kind of material can be recycled or disposed of at inert landfills. Then we manage this different type of waste and design and build the waste management unit. The class one unit to manage the hazard waste, class two unit to manage the designated waste, and a class three to manage a non-hazard waste, especially municipal solid waste. And to the right, I included a picture of the prescriptive composite liner system. That's the modern day requirement. From bottom to up, you have subgrade and you have 2 feet, no perm, we call clay. And then in between, we have HDPE, or we have the geotextile. Then on top of that, we have 1 foot drainage layer, gravel layer. So for the leachate to drain and collect. And on top of that, we have the geotextile. And then we have 2 feet of the protective soil layer. And then you put the trash on top. And I also put the inert waste unit here. This region is unique that we have a general WDR to regulate the inert waste. Even though the Title 27, it's, you know, you don't have to, but this board finds it's important to regulate this type of facility because some of them are really, really large. And it just provides some kind of regulatory certainty if we regulate them. And since this is the modern day land disposal, landfill design, I want to just go through this. From bottom to up, you see the groundwater flow, the blue color groundwater flow. And then we want to do, sorry, we have this vadal zone. So we want to have at least 5 foot separation between the bottom liner system and to groundwater. And then the liner system, as I talked about earlier, we have geocomposite liner system. And then we have this blue box is for the leachate collection and removal system. Why we need to do that? Based on the SWOT report, we discovered that many of the old landfill have leaked and they have contaminated the groundwater. Leachate is a very strongly contaminated wastewater that is generated when the rain percolates through the waste. And then, you know, pollutant transferred from the trash to the liquid when the trash decomposes. And the leachate has very high concentration of salt, COD, BOD, heavy metals, and also volatile organic chemicals, some of them the carcinogens, such as benzene, xylenes, and a chlorinated solvent, like a TCE or PCE, we'll talk about later. And so we designed so that the leachate are collected and are removed from the landfill system. Even during the operation of the landfills are covered daily to prevent odor and trash blown around. And when the landfill is complete, we put the final cover on top, again, to prevent the percolation, leachate production. And not showing on this map is the landfill gas extraction system. That is put in place to mainly to prevent the methane gas from emitting from landfills and cause the global warming. But also we learned that all these VOCs can permeate into groundwater and cause groundwater contamination as well. In addition to the engineering design, construction, we also do the monitoring, so detect the earliest possible release. And then we also request that the operator to take out financial assurance before the corrective action. So just in case there is a release, there'll be money set aside to do the cleanup. And in terms of monitoring program, there are 3 types of monitoring program we incorporate into the waste discharge requirement and this board will approve, including detection monitoring, really to detect earliest release. And the evaluation to monitoring program is to delineate the extent of the groundwater contamination and then move on to corrective action program. The discharger will have to propose engineering feasibility study to propose a remedy. And then also we need to monitor for effectiveness once the remedy is in place. This is the map that shows the land disposal facility in our region. The green dots, those are the land disposal facilities. Mainly, I want to show you, all these facilities are spread out throughout our region. Many of them are located in the groundwater basins. So it's very important for us to regulate this facility and make sure they're properly designed, constructed, and our groundwater resources are protected. Next, I'm going to go through a few tables just to show you the facility in our region. And also, as you can see their name, maybe you're you know some of the names already, or people talk to you about the names. So this table shows the active landfills in our region. Many of them going through the expansion right now. So Badland, El Sobrante, Mid Valley, Centem, FRB. And so our staff really busy reviews the design report, construction plans, and going to the inspections, make sure the liners are constructed properly. And let me go next. So this is the table that shows the closed, abandoned, inactive landfills. This is, so we call it pre-regulation landfills. None of these landfills have the liners. See many of them in Orange County. This board adopted the general WDR back in 2013 to regulate these facilities, mainly for the groundwater monitoring and the site maintenance. Here is a table for closed landfills that's not covered under the general WDRs. I have individual WDRs. Many are closed after 1984, but they're also not lined. The cover, though, is constructed according to Title 27 regulation, so that's help with the percolation, but then still we don't have liner on the bottom. And I want to show you some examples of the activities landfills. So this is the Lamb Canyon landfills. It's located in Riverside County, right off 79 State Highway, southwest of Beaumont. And this landfill is operated by Riverside County Waste Management, Department of Waste Resources. It receives waste from the community and also from two transfer stations from Coachella Valley and East Valley Transfer Station in San Bernardino County. And to the right, you'll see the terrain of the landfills is pretty steep in the Badland area. So I'll quickly go over the liner expansion that's completed there. On the top left is the material we use for the liner. And the white side is up to prevent the sun. You know, in Southern California, it can get really hot. So the white liner top reflect the light so the liner will not melt. And that did happen in the past. And the liner it gets so hot. So we have this one picture to the right shows the worker or just deploys a liner on a slope and then start to move onto the floor. And the lower right here, you see this cell is just completed. And to the lower left, this is the anchor trench. That's how we tie the liner, bury it so it won't, when the trash place in, it won't be pulling down. Next one is Frank Bowerman landfill. This is in Orange County. I probably can see from the toll road and the foothill. And luckily, it's outside the groundwater basin. So we can know doing better. So we don't place landfill in the groundwater basin. And this picture looks like a jigsaw puzzle. It's really is expansion phases. It's really how the county depends on the funding, the dirt, or a landslide. They plan their expansion. It's really in a very unique fashion. But I want to draw your attention to phase 8B. And then the fire damage caused by a Silverado fire. Silverado fire occurred October 26, 2020. And it's damaged the liner just being completed at phase 8B1, 8B2, and this picture shows some of the liner already burned off on the slope, and some you still see the smoke and smoldering. Here is a close-up look, the comparison, the exposed slope where you know the liner just put in have not been covered by soil or trash being burned off, and to the right is a peel back of the protective soil. They see they're intact, and as a worker standing on top of the PCS, the Because of the liner, it's made of HDP, it's plastic. We learned it actually burns. So here is a picture of the after. So the Orange County Waste and Recycle and the contractor have to remove the burned liners to the cleanup and then replace the new one. And also they have to replace some of the landfill gas pipeline that was damaged during the fire. And the place the new subgrade soil, the new liner material. That's what it looked like after the repair, and they pushed the soil right against the slope. Our next example is the Colton landfill closure. And this landfill started operating in 1964, and then we put right next river, Santa Ana River, Santa Ana River and a 10 freeway. So this was operated by San Bernardino County Solid Waste Management Division. The landfill, the facility opened in 1964 and it closed in 2014. So this one is not lined and right next to the river, about 82 acres and the volume of the trash about 15 million cubic yard trash. So the right now the Colton landfill is going through a closure. They choose a alternative cover, you see from bottom to top is foundation layer one foot, basically that's the soil on top of the trash. And then we talk about the linear low density, LLDE, okay. And then on top we put on closure turf and then on the top of that put a sand ballast. And during this covering construction design process, the county decided to use a replace all their gas extraction system. So that includes 57 new wells and new headers and a leachate. This is a close-up look of the turf. It's a yellow color. And the county selected this color to match the summer hill color in the area. And to prevent theft. If they have put on the green turf, they're afraid that the people are going to come in and cut and steal the turf. And here's the after the turf placed down, and then we spray the sand to hold down the turf so it won't be lifted by wind. And the new gas header to the left, and then the road being improved. And to the right, this is a new gabion put in to improve the drainage and prevent invention, the erosion. So this site, we're gonna present to you future meetings about this WDR. So here, I'm gonna pause here, see if you have any questions about landfills. If not, I'm gonna move on, okay. All right, the next type of facility we regulate is a surface impoundment. These are facility in red text or active landfills. I'm sorry, active surface impoundment, maybe just pond. And then a facility in black text are the closed surface impoundment. I use one facility as example, the GATX brine pond, just to show you what's look like. And this is a GATX pond. Location is in the city of Colton. This is the 10 freeway. This is a Pepper Avenue. You get off Pepper Avenue. And it's operated by GATX Rail Corporation. This facility here is called Colton Rail Yard. And this facility doing the rail cart cleaning, rail car cleaning service. And because cleaning wastewater is generated at the facility, and then you dispose the wastewater in the three above ground ponds here. We'll talk about that in a minute. And this facility is regulated by a waste discharge requirement issued by this board. Here is example the rail car cleaning yard. So all these tankers either has a chemical, petroleum, or sometimes have a food as well. So these cars need to be washed, rinsed, and wastewater collected. Let's see the next one. So this is where the wastewater is collected in the equalization basin and for the sludge to settle. And the water will go through this oil water separator to further separate out the oil from the water. And the water is piped into the three ponds, above ground pond. Here is a schematic design for the pond liner. From top to bottom, you have primary liner system, and we have a geo textile and a geo net as a drainage layer, and then have a secondary liner system. And in between, we have the detection, we call sump, to detect if there's any leak from the primary liner system. The liquid will collect into the sump and drain through the pipe outside the pond. And then there is a pipe riser. We request either daily or weekly monitoring in case there's any leak. Here's just some pictures to show you the progress of the construction. Here's the workers doing the subgrade preparation. And this is a look at the drainage layer, we call it GeoNet. And the liner is placed in. Next picture called electronic leak location survey. So when the liner is completed, placed in, you fill the pond with 3 feet of water and conduct this electronic leak location survey to see if there's any leak in the primary liner system. And the resolution is about 1.4 millimeters. So if there any leak is discovered, then they need to find out exactly where the leakage is and then do the repair until then do the survey again until you find no leak at all. And here's a picture that to show the pond in service. I'm going to pause here before I move on to the next topic. Any questions?
Are there any questions from the board at this time?
No? Okay, I'll move on then.
Real quick question.
Oh, sorry.
Going back to the slide showing all the surface impoundments, how many of them are active now?
Okay, sorry. I have a table. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah, 5 active surface impoundments in our region, yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, I go back to. Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Yes. Thank you. So far, this report is very comprehensive. On slide 30, where they wash the rail cars, do they document the type of material that the particular rail car carried at one time or other, or the most recent one?
These facility 19, you know, these.
Oh, okay, do they just wash them? Is that what they're saying?
Yes,
they just scrub them?
Yes, the facility is being in operation since 1977. And over time, originally they just have a concrete pond, and then over time we asked them, no, you have to line the concrete. The concrete might crack, right? Might leak. So, in terms, we require monitoring of the pond water, but I don't remember if we asked them to document what kind of material, what kind of cars are washed.
Because they could be carrying hazardous.
No, that cannot. It's in our WD. Yeah, that's definitely yes, a prohibition. Yes, they cannot. Yes.
Oh.
They cannot. Yes, that's correct. I mentioned petroleum because you probably know that petroleum is exempt from CERCLA and the food, so it has to be non-hazardous material.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
That's yeah. They cannot dispose the
okay.
hazards.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for that question.
Thank you, Board Member Lopez. Any other? Okay, please continue.
All right. So next thing you talk about a composting. Regulatory program because the state mandate to divert organic waste from landfill to basically reduce the emission of the methane, we have to we've seen the composting operation increase in our region. So we start to regulate composting, start with a waiver, 1996. As you know, waiver, this is a waste discharge requirement waiver, expires after 5 years. And then we work with the state board to develop a, we start to talk about a waiver, state board waiver, but then, you know, waiver always expires after 5 years. So state board decided to do a waste discharge requirement. So that came out 2015. And then that order also amended in 2020 again. So we rely, our region, with our staff rely on the state board general order to regulate the composting facilities in our region. And here's a list of the composting facilities in our region. And I'll go show you one example. This is the Southern California Landscape Supply, located in the Lakeview area. You see this Bridge Street and Gilman Spring Road here. And there's a Mystic Lake to the left. It's a facility right here. And this facility is outside the 100-year flood zone. So it receives the greenways, horse stable beddings, manures, deer manure from the area, surrounding area. It also takes the landscape waste from the Forest Service when the Forest Service conducts its fuel reduction program. And the water quality protection measure on site include a basin to capture all the stormwater and leachate, and also compacted the soil, and so prevent the percolation of leachate reaching groundwater. Here's some pictures of the material come in. It's a receiving, unloading material, and you'll see it's from the bottom left. This material looks pretty dirty. That's how, unfortunately, the landscape material come in, full of trash. So they have to hire labor to manually remove the trash from these green waste. And here is an example of the wood chips. And this looks like a horse bedding material. And here is the finished compost pile that provides the material to either consumer to come to buy from the facility that sell to wholesale to the like a Home Depot or Lowe's. All right, next we're going to talk about a groundwater cleanup activities. Do you have any question on composting?
Any questions, Director or Board Member Alvarado?
Some of the counties actually give out compost, right?
Yes. Yes.
Does that have an impact on some of these work, and at what level? Because what I heard from the counties is that there's not enough, I guess, need, or there might be a need, but the communities don't know that they're actually giving it out.
That's
right?
Correct. Yes. The both landfill in Orange County, the FRB and Olinda, they offer, you know, operate two composting facility, one called decanning, that's in FRB, another Valencia Greenery. So that, yeah, both facilities give out compost for free. I don't know, people maybe just think it's a hassle to drive to the landfill, or just easier to go to Home Depot to buy a bag. And I know it's a transfer station, the Nelson Transfer Station in Ogmanza also give out the, not the finished composting facility, product, but the chip and grind material, pre-composting. And you can just go get your, drive your car there and load as much as you want. I know some of my colleagues get there before, but they said the ones that give out for free are not very clean because, you know, the trash probably not pick up really well.
I understand.
Yes. And then also maybe, yeah, the county, this is a good question. You know, county place the composting on top of landfill for a reason, because people, they are already at the landfill, they're already, people take the recycling park, you know, take the electronics, they're already green waste there, they have to sort through. So it makes sense to do the composting on top of landfill. So I think the Riverside County, Lamb Canyon, and Batland also have composting co-located in the landfill. And St. Tim does that as well. And usually they will use this green waste as a daily cover, you know, cover up the slope to prevent the erosion, but they also give, you know, have the give out program if people want to, you know, go there and pick them up.
I think what we need to do is maybe partner with them so that there's more advertised, you know, and more outreach. But thank you. Thank you for explaining that.
All right. Thank you.
Yep.
No, I was just going to make a comment. I was actually involved where I volunteer in Huntington Beach. I was involved in a compost day giveaway, and what we gave away was very high quality compost. It wasn't dirty, stinky, smelly stuff. It was actually great, you know, gardening, you know, soil gardening amendment. And another big thing about this was that it was weed seed free, and that's a big requirement of gardeners. So it's so definitely when a city does have a big compost giveaway, I mean, people should definitely take advantage of that. And it's all free compost. Again, it's high quality compost. So
thanks. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Board Member Alvarado, as well. I agree. We need to help ring the bell and let people know what's out there.
Okay. Yep. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, the last topic is on groundwater cleanup at the land disposal facilities. And I mentioned, you know, older landfills do not have liners, so they have release occurred, we call it a pre-regulation landfill site. And normally, the contaminants discovered are a low concentration of volatile organic compounds or chemicals. And the cleanup effort we include improving the cover and the drainage, so you prevent the water infiltration into the trash to generate, you know, leachate, and improve the landfill gas extraction to remove the volatile organic compounds. And the earlier, even 1990s, we require some dischargers to conduct pump and treat when the groundwater are contaminated. And then when these pump and treat wells, the pumping wells are going dry, it converts that into soil vapor extraction. It turns out the soil vapor extraction removes more mass VOCs than the pump and treat remedy. And later on, we also move on to this off-site in situ bioremediation. So use this example at the Yucaipa landfill to illustrate this. Yucaipa landfill is online class 3 landfill, operated in 1963 to 1980. It's located in the foothills. Is a Crafton Hill area off city of Yucaipa. And this site, when the groundwater monitoring well was installed in 1980s during the SWAT program, discovered the VOCs, volatile organic compounds in the groundwater. And this board issued a NOVI's cleanup abatement orders back in 2002. And as a result, the operators improved their surface water drainage. And in 2008, the landfill gas extraction installed. So all that helped, but we already have groundwater contaminated. So I want to show you the groundwater contour map. And it's, again, the Crafton Hill fault zone here, and they're during the study, evaluation monitoring program study, they found lots of buried fault line as well in the valley. So groundwater flowed down the hill initially and then flow west, follow the regional groundwater flow direction. And the top here, this is a groundwater recharge basin here. So the two groundwater plumes were discovered. One is dominated by a trichloroethane, we call TCE plume, to the east or south. Another plume called the tetrachloroethane, the PCE plume, dominated by PCE to the west. The proposed remedy is enhanced bioremediation. This is just a schematic to show you how this works. You start with a fully chlorinated ethane, the full chlorine onto ethane backbone, and the daughter product TCE, you lose one chlorine replaced by hydrogen, and then you lose two chlorine. You have a DCE and a minor chloride until the ethane is fully, all the chlorine is removed. As I mentioned, all these daughter products are just as toxic, and they cause carcinogens as well. So we want to make sure this declaration process is complete and all the way to ethane, which is gas. The remediation proposed by the county is to do injection at this three, oh, most like a two sites, the bullseye of each plume, Y16 and Y20. It's three injection point and a monitor at one, just to see the effect of the ejection. And the injection always happens in two phases. First phase injection is you basically provide some kind of food for bacteria to change the environment to a reductive environment, and then inject the bioaugmentation, basically the bacteria that actually cause the declaration to occur. So I'm going to show you some concentration change over time. It's actually hard for me to see the color here. So this is a brown color. Is this TCE? Trichloroethane, yeah. And then here the injection point. You see that immediately, you know, TCE concentration to decrease. And the green color is the DCE, and the concentration going up. This is the Y16. That's where the TCE plume at the heart is at. And so we know that there is declaration occurring, but we, you know, this DCE is just as a toxic. So then the second injection is to add the halococcoides to actually cause the declaration to happen to the end. So it seems to have done the work so that this DCE decreased. But you do see this rebound in terms of potential. Let's say EX, I mean, reduction oxidation potential does rebound. So they're doing this is the first injection, second injection, third injection. They're proposing to do the another injection to completely reduce all this chlorine dissolvent to ethane. And here it's a concentration diagram at Y20. Again, that's the PCE plume. PCE is blue in blue here. And the first injection occurred here. And you see the PCE decreased and then DCE increased. You know, declaration is occurring, but it's not what we want. So they inject the augmentation, the halococcoides to push the declaration to the end. But we also see the rebound. You see the rebound after ejection, you know, concentration come down and then the concentration come up again. So they're doing the re-injection, each this one full injection, second one, third one, and planning to do an injection of the ejection. So the work is ongoing at the Yucaipa landfill. So with that, I think that's all I have today. And this is our staff contact information in case you have any questions.
Thank you so much. So I will open it up to our board members for questions and or comments. Any board member Lopez?
I really don't know. Excuse me. I don't really know what question to ask, but this is very comprehensive. You know, I really appreciate it. You know, it's very thorough, and I've seen reports before from, you know, other staff agencies, but this is the most comprehensive and well put together. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Vice Chair Skinder?
Sure. Well, thank you, Cindy. Excellent presentation. And the interesting thing is that I did quite a bit of this work for a number of decades at the Department of Toxic Substances Control, working with water board staff from most of the regions in the state. And so it's something I'm very familiar with. I think on your third slide, you mentioned one of the staff, Patricia Hannon, and I worked with her for many years on military bases. And of course, when I saw the list of abandoned landfills, closed and abandoned landfills, I noticed the military base landfills were missing from that. And that was actually a significant amount of work that was expended by water board staff, you know, Patricia, Nick Amini, and many others. And so I remember there was at least five landfills at El Toro. There was a couple at Tustin. There were some pretty big landfills at March and Norton Air Force Base. And the interesting thing about these landfills was they were essentially, they were operated from the 40s and 50s and 60s until not all that many years, until the 90s. and they were basically holes in the ground. And so they had, and they operated with very little standards. And so when they closed the landfills, the staff were involved in all the investigations, as well as the design of liners and leak detection systems and gas extraction systems. So they spent a significant amount of work on that. So I think we should include those as part of our list of abandoned landfills or closed landfills. A couple of other questions. So as far as the list of active landfills in the region, are they strictly MSW and inert waste? Are there any designated landfills in the region?
They're all municipal solid landfill. It's MWS.
Okay, so yes. So we don't have any designated waste landfills for designated waste.
No.
Certainly no class one landfills. I think you mentioned a little bit about the burn dumps at the very beginning, and for everybody's edification, what those were. And these operated primarily until the 1970s, I think it was. Until that time, people were actually able to burn their waste in incinerators. And a lot of old homes still have those incinerators, even though they can't use them. And then they would take the ash and take them to these landfills. And do we have much of that? Do we get involved much in those landfills at all?
Yes, some of these so-called CAI I mentioned earlier. You know, old days, it's like not like a pure burn dump. You probably have burning trash and then dump the trash at the same time. So a lot of the old landfill, majority of the materials there are burned dump. For example, Pedley landfill and right on Santa Ana River, you look at the trash. Yeah, people actually go there to dig for these old bottles.
Yeah.
So the ash, mostly ash, but also the trash as well. So Orange County, lots of this old landfill in Orange County, probably a combination of the burn dump plus the trash. So.
Right. And then a lot of them, of course, appear in redevelopment plans years ago when Riverside City College built their Norco campus. Sure enough, there was an old burn dump from the hospital that the military used to have there. So it's quite an extensive problem. So anyway, great presentation. I think it, you know, shows everybody here how complicated this work is. And we really appreciate all the work done by you and your staff and all the people that are involved in these.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Skinder, and thank you, Ms. Lee, for the presentation. It was very thorough and greatly appreciated. Appreciate your work. Okay, so now we will move on to item 11, because that was an information item. Item 11 is about our underground storage tank cleanup case study, specifically to ARCO. And Miguel Oviedo, our engineering geologist, will present a case study on a recently closed underground storage tank cleanup case in the Santa Ana region. Please welcome. Thank you for your time.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Murray, board members, and water board staff. Yes, I will be presenting one of my former cases. This is a former UST case I managed and helped close. And this is the ARCO 5346 fueling station. Give me a second. So I will go over some of the background information for this case. That'll include site assessment and remedial activities, and also the path to closure using the low threat closure policy that's issued by State Water Board. Okay, next. So yeah, first we'll go over some of the background. So the site is located at 250 Diamond Drive in the city of Lake Elsinore, just off of the Diamond Drive and railroad crossing exit and the 15 freeway. The ARCO station is a currently active fueling facility. Next. So So this figure here shows the ARCO station in the top left, highlighted in blue. The blue monitoring wells associated with this case are also highlighted there. Across the street to the south is mobile station 18991, which is highlighted in yellow, and its monitoring wells are labeled in black. The mobile station currently has an open case that is currently in the closure process and has a history with the ARCO site, which is why I'm including that here. Next. So here's a map showing the site and its location relative to Lake Elsinore and also the San Jacinto River, which feeds into Lake Elsinore. Next. All right. The site overlies the Elsinore Groundwater Management Zone. And according to our basin plan, the beneficial uses of this zone include municipal, agricultural, and industrial uses. Next. So this is a site map showing data from the last groundwater monitoring report dated August of 2021. The map shows the general groundwater flow direction that is to the south, southwest. And at that time, depth to groundwater was at approximately 47 feet below the ground surface. Soil beneath the site consists mostly of fine to coarse grained sands at shallow depths and coarser sands with gravel for the deeper soils. So this is another larger scale groundwater flow map showing the ARCO and mobile stations on the left. And this was included just to show the extent of the investigation with some of the mobile wells far down gradient. Okay, so some of the history here on the site. So in November of 1998, the fuel station went through some fuel system upgrades. And those upgrades included fuel dispenser and pipeline upgrades. Soil samples were collected in the areas where these upgrades were performed. And soil samples were collected for chemical analysis. And the results showed that gasoline had impacted soils below the fuel dispensers. In February of 1999, the Riverside County Department of Environmental Health issued a notice of responsibility to ARCO Products. The notice of responsibility identified ARCO as the responsible party for the release, for the unauthorized release, and requested corrective action. The chemicals of concern at the site include total petroleum hydrocarbons as gasoline, or TPHG, benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylenes, collectively known as BTEX, tertiary butyl alcohol, or TBA, and methyl tertiary butyl ether, or MTBE. MTBE was the primary driver of this investigation. Noteworthy is that MTBE is known to travel rapidly through soil and is very soluble in water. So it transports faster than the other chemicals of concern at this for this investigation. Okay, so I'll present some key points of the site assessment work and the remedial history. So the initial investigation following the notice of responsibility was performed in January of 2000. Three soil borings were advanced around the dispenser islands And they were drilled down to groundwater. At that time, groundwater was approximately 42 feet below the ground surface. Once soil boring was converted to a groundwater monitoring well, MW1, soil and groundwater samples were collected in this investigation and analyzed for the chemicals of concern. TPHG, BTEX, and MTBE concentrations were measured in soil and groundwater, but the groundwater samples showed higher concentrations. In October of 2002, the lead agency oversight responsibilities were transferred from Riverside County to the Santa Ana Water Board. So site assessment work was performed at the site from January 2000 through August 2021. Throughout the years of investigation, 34 groundwater monitoring wells were installed to characterize the contaminant plume, and some wells were also utilized for remediation purposes. Once the well network was extended off-site towards the neighboring mobile station, it was discovered that the ARCO contaminant plume was commingled with the mobile station contaminant plume, and MTBE was the primary chemical of concern. In about 2010 or so, the commingled plume stretched a maximum length of approximately 600 feet towards the south down gradient. The plume was also characterized vertically, and low concentrations of MTBE and TBA were discovered as far down as 135 feet below ground surface. So in February of 2002, the Riverside County Department of Environmental Health approved the groundwater extraction and treatment system work plan. Following the approval, the system was installed in April of 2002 and operated between 2002 and 2012. The system utilized groundwater wells MW6, MW7, and MW9, and those are highlighted in yellow in the figure there. Later, groundwater wells MW18, MW23, and MW24 were added for extraction purposes, and those are highlighted in blue. A total of over 4 million gallons of impacted groundwater were extracted and treated using the system, and it was calculated that 451 pounds of MTBE and 115 pounds of TBA were removed through these efforts. This table summarizes the historical maximum concentrations of constituents of concern versus their respective concentrations measured in the final groundwater monitoring event in 2021. As you can see, there's a great drop with the concentrations there. Next. So I will go over the low threat closure policy, closure criteria, and how the ARCO case conditions satisfied the criteria. The low threat closure policy became effective in 2012, and it applies only to petroleum impact cases. Most of them are UST cases. The policy also has a set of general criteria and media-specific criteria that must be satisfied for case closure and are protective of human health and the environment. The policy also requires that a 60-day public notification is sent to the UST owner operators, to adjacent property owners and local water district and other interested local agencies. So in October of 2021, the consultant requested case closure and demonstrated that the site conditions at the time met the criteria of the low threat closure policy. The low threat closure policy contains 8 general criteria, and the general criteria requires that the primary unauthorized release has been stopped, that any remaining mass has been removed to the maximum extent practicable, that the unauthorized release must consist only of petroleum. Also, soil or groundwater must have been tested for MTBE, and that nuisance conditions do not exist at the site. Did I miss a step? I think, let's go to, oh no, we're good. Sorry about that. So yeah, 18. Okay, so in conjunction with the general criteria, the low threat closure policy contains 3 media specific criteria. The first of those is the groundwater specific criteria. So the policy contains 5 categories for groundwater specific conditions, of which one needs to be satisfied. The ARCO site met conditions of groundwater specific criteria number 2, and those are italicized there on the slide. That criteria is that the contaminant plume that exceeds water quality objectives is less than 250 feet in length, that there's no free product at the site. The nearest existing water supply well or surface water body is greater than 1,000 feet from the defined plume boundary, and that dissolved concentration of benzene is less than 3,000 micrograms per liter, and MTBE is less than 1,000 micrograms per liter. For this case, the commingled plume measured 120 feet in length and was decreasing over time. Free product had not been measured at the site's groundwater monitoring wells. The San Jacinto River, which is the closest water body, was located to the west at approximately 1,000 feet away from the contaminant plume boundary, and it was also cross gradient. And lastly, benzene concentrations in groundwater were non-detect, and maximum concentrations of MTBE were no greater than 180 micrograms per liter, satisfying the criteria for this for groundwater. Here's a map showing the MTBE plume in 2010, measuring approximately 600 feet, and that plume is shown there with the red concentration contour lines. And then here is the same plume in 2021, measuring approximately 120 feet, as shown by the yellow concentration contour lines. The second media specific criteria is the petroleum vapor intrusion to indoor air criteria. In this case, there's an exception. The low threat closure policy has an exception to this criteria if the site operates as an active fueling facility, which is the case for the ARCO facility. At that time, it was operating as a fueling facility and still is to this day. The reasoning behind the exception is that exposures to petroleum vapors associated with the historical release are considered insignificant compared to exposures from typical fueling facility operations. And satisfaction of this criteria was not required for the active fueling facility. The third media specific criteria is the direct contact and outdoor air exposure criteria. Table 1 of the low threat closure policy, shown there on the slide, contains soil concentration maximum values for benzene, ethyl benzene, naphthalene, and polyaromatic hydrocarbons for the upper 10 feet of soil. For this site, benzene concentrations in soil were non-detect, and ethyl benzene concentrations were below the commercial industrial values listed. Soil was not analyzed for naphthalene. However, the State Water Board and regional boards agree that if concentrations of benzene and ethyl benzene are low or not detected above laboratory detection limits, then naphthalene concentrations are expected to be similar. And then last on the list, polyaromatic hydrocarbon analysis, that is required for sites where soil was affected by waste oil or if there was a waste oil tank at the site. And neither was the case for the ARCO site. Therefore, PAH analysis was not required. And this criteria was satisfied. In December of 2022, the Santa Ana Water Board issued the 60-day public notification of case closure to the interested parties, and those included the responsible party, their consultant, the Lake Elsinore Building Department, Elsinore Valley Municipal Water District, Riverside County Water District, and adjacent property owners and occupants overlying the affected area. No comments were received during the comment period or after. So after the 60-day period lapsed, the Santa Ana Water Board issued the well destruction directive to the RP, or responsible party. And between April and May of 2023, all site investigation wells were destroyed and the remedial system was demolished. All of that information was submitted to us in a report. And after reviewing the well destruction and system demolition report, the Santa Ana Water Board concurred that all conditions were met for case closure, and a no further action letter was issued to the responsible party in June of 2023. And that concludes my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Yes. Successful questions? Case study. So thank you for that.
Madam Chair, can I address the board for a moment?
Of course.
Thank
please.
You. Thanks, Miguel. Good job. So we have six water board staff working on the UST program at any given time. We have 101 active cases. We've closed approximately 50 in the last 5 years, 600 total. This year, we're on track to have fewer than 100 open cases for the first time since inception of the program. That's pretty big news. While case closures undergo a public notice and public comment process, these cases rarely appear at board meetings. No news is good news. A big part of my job as assistant executive officer is to bring the worst cases before you for enforcement action. Today, Miguel has presented you one of the better cases. So achieving case closure is a positive outcome for groundwater quality, the public interest, and the environment as a whole. This information item is an example of the work that board staff do on a daily basis. So we appreciate the opportunity to present this to the board. Thank you.
Well, we appreciate the incredible work, and that is an exciting milestone. So thank you for sharing that as supplemental information to the board. So I'd like to open it up for comments or questions. I see several, so we'll start.
I don't have a question, but it, going back to my days of when I was doing property profiles way several years back, over 10 years ago, and someone asked me to do a property profile on that particular site, because they were interested in that area, and I discovered, you know, something, some little letter or something in the files from somewhere, I can't remember where I did, but I didn't even know that it was this extensive, you know, and I just, at the time, you know, when we were doing it, I said, you know, this is what it is, so I think that they stayed away from that property, so now I, after reading this, you know, I said, I'm thankful that they did, you know, but
yes.
Yeah, I just after I was thinking about it, I said, God, that in my memory, I said, I remember doing something in that area, and that was it. So, yeah, thank you for the report. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yep, board member Alvarado.
Once again, I just want to say thank you. This is extremely informational, and I think it showcases the work that is being done. And so I think the members of the community will definitely think by learning and hearing reports like this, because this case study just shows the work and the commitment and the follow-up and follow-through that this agency actually does. So thank you to the staff, and thank you for the all the cases that have been closed. And thank you for dealing with them so that we only have to deal with the most difficult ones. So I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep, board member.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
After you.
All right, okay. Miguel, thank you for the presentation. Slide 16 kind of stood out to me about the 60-day public notification.
Yes.
And as you mentioned, no news is good news, but sometimes I'm concerned when there are no public comments, if the community or the people who were notified are aware of what their comments should be, or how that, what they're discussing or what's being notified is, how that impacts them. So how do we get a good sense that the public notices not only went to the right people, but the information was conveyed to them in a way where they understand the possible impacts and what they should be commenting on?
Okay, so for this case, I do recall there was only, I did receive one phone call, but it was because it was something like that. They didn't understand the scope or the reason we were even reaching out. And so I did spend a little bit of time going over some of the case information with that person. And in our notifications that are mailed out, the package includes the closure summary. And in this case, I think the closure summary was maybe 10 pages, because this case has a very long history. So all the details were there, and of course not everybody understands all the chemistry and some of the details in there. So I went over that with the interested person, and then once we talked about it, they didn't have any other comments to make.
That's good to know. Yeah, I mean, sometimes this can be, this subject matter is a little nuanced, and it can be complicated and overwhelming, I think, to the average citizen. So it's good to know that we're taking that time for people who may be reaching out. My concern is just that person who's not taking that extra step to call or reach out, but just something to keep in mind when we get zero comments on, you know, something as important as this. But very interesting case study. I appreciate you presenting it in the way that you did, because it just feels very relatable that, you know, this could happen anywhere near us. So thank you.
Yes, and if you know, this area, I believe, is mostly commercial.
Okay.
So, you know, I think there's like a Taco Bell and a McDonald's, and, you know, it's right off the freeway. So there's a lot of places like to eat and little shops and stuff like that. But we've had, you know, cases where we have like 30 or more residential properties that we have to contact. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes we'll get questions about, you know, from those people. And I will say that a lot of times when people contact me, it's they see a government notice and they think, what does the government want with me? So we get some of those, and you know,
yeah, am I in trouble?
But we always make things clear as much as we can.
That's appreciated. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good points and questions. And I know board member Lopez also has a question, if you want him to follow up real quick, and then we'll close with Vice Chair Skinner.
No, I was just going to ask, is this the only, or the other sites that you're currently reviewing, or relative to gas stations, service stations, any current ones, or is it the only one?
I don't have the exact total, but there are 101 cases where a release has occurred. Many of those are gas stations, but there are also oil and gasoline tank farms, for example, We don't have, I don't think we have any refineries in our region, but that would be a candidate. There are some industrial sites too that utilize underground storage tanks for petroleum. So the 101 open cases that we're chipping away at incorporate all of those.
Okay, well, thank you, Miguel and Eric, for the excellent presentation. As opposed to landfills, I didn't, in my career, I didn't get involved too much in petroleum underground storage tanks, and the reason being is that both US EPA and DTSC are subject to what's called the petroleum exclusion in both the federal and state Superfund laws. So we're statutorily, they're statutorily precluded from taking action on those types of cases. And what this petroleum exclusion did was it saddled the water boards with thousands upon thousands of these tank cases up and down the state in the 80s and 90s. And it's taken a long time for these agencies to, the water boards to address these. So now it's good to see that now we're reaching a milestone of less than 100 cases, and hopefully it won't be too long where there's not too many of those left. The low threat closure policy can sometimes be a very controversial policy, especially when communities or activist groups or residents hear about it, because they can say, well, gee, are you supposed to clean up everything in there? Well, what the policy reflects is the fact that over time, you reach a point of diminishing returns where the public health and water quality benefits you've achieved all of them. There's no more benefit to be achieved from that. And so it's best that those dollars be spent on other more high priority cases. Mm-hmm. And then last of all, it's interesting that, you know, MTBE is mentioned because back in the 80s, that was considered a miracle fuel additive. They would add MTBE to fuels, and it did a great job of reducing hydrocarbons coming out of the tailpipes. But back then, a lot of the underground tanks didn't have leak detection or liner systems in place. And so this stuff spread all over the place. It was just a nightmare of a problem, and it just kind of demonstrates how, you know, solving one environmental problem creates another environmental problem. Just a couple quick questions. I noticed on the map that the sites, the two gas stations, seem proximate to Lake Elsinore and San Jacinto River. Did they ever pick up any impacts to those surface water bodies?
No. My understanding is that there were no impacts to the river or to Lake Elsinore. I think the lake is about a mile away to the west, and also cross gradient from the direction of groundwater flow. Okay. And those wells that were shown on the large map, I think that was on figure 9. The wells that are down at the bottom there, or I should say to the right, but in south direction, those wells, the concentrations there were non-detect. So,
okay, that's good to know. And then commingled plumes are always a nightmare, because when you go to the responsible party, the first thing they say is, well, that's not coming from my mm-hmm. site, it's coming from the guy across the street. And then you go across the street and they say the same thing about about the other guy. How did we deal a lot with that sort of thing, and how did that all get resolved as far as who paid for, you know, cleaning up the commingled plume?
These sites, I believe they were both, the investigations were funded through the UST Cleanup Fund. I know that for the ARCO site, they used about $1.49 million for the cleanup, and the mobile station also has money for their part of it. So I don't think there was too much of that going on, but the mobile station also used a groundwater extraction and treatment system, to clean up their portion.
So mobile used their own funds from the oil company to pay for that, and then ARCO, did they use the state funds, or did they?
Or no, both used the cleanup fund money.
Hmm.
Yeah,
and then from the state, and then will the state be reimbursed for that money by the oil companies?
No. Mm-hmm. That The fund is actually it's funded through our, you know,
taxes,
yeah, the taxes that we pay at the pump.
I see.
I believe it's like 2 cents a gallon.
Okay.
For every gallon dispensed, so you know that money, you know, goes to the fund, and then it's used to clean up some of these sites.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate it. And please extend our appreciation to the entire staff that works on these cases, because I can only imagine the workload, but we're very, very appreciative as a region. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so thank you with that. And we'll conclude that item and move on to item 12 and ask Jane to present. I'd like to ask Jane to present her executive officer's report.
I don't have anything additional to report, but there is a discussion on the latest Ford Aeronautics work group meeting or public meeting that we held. So
wonderful. Thank you. Okay, now I'd like to open it up to board members, and I will go all the way down to the end with Board Member Lopez. Any closing remarks? Board Member Alvarado, thank you.
Just a, you know, thank you again to the staff for the report, and keep it up. Keep up the good work. And thank you for sharing once again. I feel that this is a way to inform the community and keep the community aware of what's going on and the work that is being done. Thank you again.
Yep, Board Member Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just thank you to everyone for the insightful and informative presentations. I feel like we're talking about so many issues that are we're dealing with on a day-to-day basis, like composting and, you know, just things that are becoming more aware to the general public. I've been listening to NPR and hearing about the negotiations about the Colorado River. And it's just, it feels like a lot of these issues that have been talked about with this board for a very long time and other similar boards are now coming to the surface of being in mainstream conversations. And so that's good news for our outreach efforts and just bringing some of these complex issues to become more palatable to the average citizen. So that's exciting. But yeah, thank you for all of the presentations and have a good weekend.
Vice Chair.
And I too thank the staff and the executive officer for all the presentations. They're all great today. Excellent presentations. We aren't going to have a meeting next month. We're going to be dark next month. I think we come back together. I think it's late July, but rest assured, we're all going to be staying on top of all the issues that are happening both in this region as well as the state. And as Vice Chair D'Adamo mentioned earlier, there's a lot of stuff going on at the state level. And so much for us to keep track of. So look forward to seeing you all at the meeting in July.
Great. And I'd also just like to reiterate that we'll all be engaged in the stormwater discussions for the region. Want to have the public rest assured that the board and the staff heard their concerns from the major permittees and others that were represented today. And we'll continue to be responsive to their needs. And then also just a huge thank you to our staff who presented today and your teams that do so much work on behalf of the residents and those who work and visit our region. And then again, I'd like to close in honor and in memory of Shirley Detloff for her decades of service to the wonderful city of Huntington Beach, as well as our entire region. Her footprint and legacy carry on. And so we'll close today in her memory. Thank you, everyone, and have a wonderful and safe and lovely weekend.